Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. It's 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, and if it's 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, that means you're listening to The Business of the Business here on the Heritage Radio Network. And The Business of the Business is hosted by yours truly, Phil Colicchio. And on this show, we explore the ins and outs, the ups and downs of the business side of the hospitality industry, whether it's restaurants or whether it's star chefs or whether it's hotels. We peel away the layer and we try to see what makes them work from an economic standpoint, from a business standpoint, and sometimes from a public relations standpoint. If you miss this broadcast, and it's very rare, but occasionally someone misses this broadcast, you can go to our www.heritageradionetwork.org archive, and you can plug in Business of the Business, and you can catch any one of our shows. They're archived every week, or as a podcast on iTunes. So without further ado, we're going to get down to business today. If you are a regular listener of the show, you usually expect me now to give some degree of an introduction. But today, in honor of my guest, we're going to go almost completely unscripted. Because that's the way Scott Conant has approached his career. We have Super Chef Scott Conant, I will say of Scarpetta restaurant, but that would be cheating, Scott, because he has created more restaurants than you can count on your two hands combined. In a relatively short amount of time, and he has become quite well known as a television personality, particularly on the television show Chopped. And that doesn't define my friend Scott Conant, but it sure does give him a leg up when he when he's on the street and people say, "Hey, you! I saw you on that thing." Good afternoon, Scott. How are you?
Thanks very much. You can introduce me anytime, by the way. I appreciate that.
No, you know what? When we have a guest on who's as quiet and subtle and as low key as you, I don't like to waste time on introductions. I like to get right down to it.
I like to keep it on the down low.
You know
that about me.
Stay
humble.
Well, the down low and humble are two different things where I grew up. However,
that's a good point.
If that's the route you want to take today. So Scott, we've known each other for a while, mm-hmm. and we actually get to talk about the business of the hospitality industry on a pretty regular basis. I know it fascinates you because, A, it's how you make your living. B, it's hit you over the head many times.
Many times.
Like a brickbat, right?
And to put it nicely.
Right. And you've had – well, why put it nicely? Let's put it the way you like to put it. But you've also – you know, you've taken a few pitches under the chin, but you stayed in the batter's box. You've taken your swings. You've taken your cuts. And you're an all-star.
And no one's none the wiser, so to speak. None the wiser.
Well, you know what? Let's make the people listening today a little more the wiser. All right? Because I was going to joke around and say, you know, you can't spell success without setback, you know, and you can't spell hero without hard work. But I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, the setbacks. And I don't think we can do that without some context. Mm. tell everybody how you began in this business, and like most of your colleagues, I'm sure it was to get girls.
Well, actually, I started even younger than that. So I was 11 when I took my first cooking classes, and I was 15 when I started working full time. And it was really to get a car, which was to kind of at that point get girls, which was the intention. Little did I know that it would turn out later that the girls really like a guy who knows how to cook, which, you know, I don't know about you, but most chefs I know never have time to cook at home. So the thing the thing that gets you in the game, into the conversation, is then the same thing that gets you essentially out of the conversation.
Well, you know what? I like the beginning. That's an economic theory
right there. That's,
you know,
right.
We get right into it. So 15, you start working in restaurants, and you realize this is going to be your life, or was it just a path to something else?
You know, I was a baseball player, and I think a lot of us played baseball growing up. And the one thing that I really recall walking into the kitchen for the first time was this sense of camaraderie, this teamwork.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about the restaurant world, but I knew that this is what I wanted to do forever.
Wow.
It was as simple as that. I just really, really loved it.
Well, you know, the team component, whether it's in the kitchen, whether it's like me with a law firm, I think life is much easier to live when you have other people who are trying to row in the same direction you are. Life gets interesting, however, when one or two of those rowers begin to row in a different direction.
Well, it definitely makes for a good chapters in the book.
The to be written book, which we can't quite write until all of the releases are signed.
That's right.
But you know, you've had so much success, critical success, and economic success as a chef and restaurateur. You then took another chapter for that book into media. First it was getting written up, then it was magazines, then it was television, and the advent of, you know, the rock star chef. And you know, people think that's kind of like the plan, but as we said, unscripted life. Let's talk about where it all began to go right.
Well, you know the details of how this stuff starts and where it changed and all that kind of stuff in the mid-90s with the start of the Food Network, and then later with Bravo getting into the food space on television. But I think the long and short of it is that when I walked into that kitchen for the first time, none of this stuff was being done. I mean, no chef. Now I think about it from a television perspective. Julia Childs, Jacques Pepin, the Galloping Gourmet, whatever
Graham
his name
Kerr.
Was. Graham Kerr. And there was a guy named Jeff Smith, who I think is in jail now.
There's a lot of stories for another jail now, right?
Story for another day.
Right.
But there wasn't a lot of things going on in the media world. And with books and things like that, there wasn't a lot. There wasn't a lot of stuff there. But essentially, when it came to restaurants, especially where I'm from, a town in Waterbury, Connecticut, which is really a very blue-collar town, and there weren't any fine dining or fancy restaurants at all. So my real goal was to be able to get as close to New York City as possible, because I heard the rumor was that the food was better the closer you got to New York.
Right.
So that was my goal. So it was pretty simple.
When did it dawn on you that this was not just a place to work, but a business, and a business that you wanted to take on much more than just cooking the pasta?
You know, I don't think there was ever that moment where it just clicked, like, oh my God, this is a business. I think it was a slow, gradual thing over time, saying, you know what, if this is the competition, or if this is what these restaurant owners do, this is how they act, whether it be a lack of integrity towards your staff, a lack of integrity towards the finances or economics of that business, or just an overall lack of integrity towards their own life.
Right.
I started to feel pretty short into the game in New York City. Like, if this is the competition, I don't think I have a lot to worry about.
Really?
You know?
And that was based upon, you know, an analysis of how people were doing business, or not just the food.
Well, no, it wasn't even about the food.
I mean,
the fact of the matter is I never worked with the great chefs. I mean, I worked for Tony May at one point, and he had some good, really good chefs working with him at Sun Domenico in Central Park South in the late 80s, early 90s. And I spent some time there. But later, I decided, and it was by design. I decided that I didn't want to work for anyone and to be a disciple of anyone else. I really wanted to create my own style of food. I really wanted to kind of put my head down, focus on a flavor profile that would be unique to me, to my style of food, and something that was a little bit more personalized, if you will. So I never worked for Jean-Georges or Danielle or any of those guys, which, you know, in hindsight, maybe I missed something along the way, but I definitely surrounded myself with maybe with people who were a little bit more colorful,
right?
And maybe had a different approach to business,
right? Well, you know, that's a great
trying
point.
To be diplomatic.
No, you know what? Diplomatic is for later. You're on the radio. Diplomatic is for television. Radio, you can be straight up. It seemed like that was sort of a combination of a stylistic decision and a business decision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, colorful business partners are part of the stock and trade of the restaurant industry, right? There's always this ideal that exists in a lot of minds that there's, you know, that there's a genius in the kitchen and then there's a Sharpie who's running the books, you know, and that hopefully those two can combine their skills, you know, to have some success and then maybe do more. But you were also on the front lines of really the explosion of popularity of great food. You were one of the early guys to get in on the third-party contracting.
Yeah, well,
that came out of the food popularity boom, yeah. Right, in the 90s. Tell me about the first, you know, I love talking about the restaurants in New York,
yeah.
But where it gets fun for me is, okay, here's a guy who thought he's seen it all, and now somebody's knocking on his door saying, we want you to come out and put one of your restaurants in our hotel. Did that make any sense to you when it first came up?
I had heard about some of these things. And obviously Vegas was especially the Bellagio. I feel like the Bellagio in 1998 were the first people starting to do these management contracts. And correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was 98.
You're dead right.
So it was, you know, Jean-Georges and Michael Mina and Todd English.
Who came out of nowhere, really. I mean, Michael Mina had a nice little thing going in San Francisco, but
Michael Mina's a close friend, and I think Michael, to hear him tell the story, he was like, I fell into it. I got this phone call. It was like, how do I not do this?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, you know, Aqua worked out really well with him, but he's a guy you should talk to because he's happy to tell his own story, and I'm not going to tell it for him. I got my own bag of rocks.
But bring it. Bring him. Bring him.
But, you know, when I first got that phone call, and it was the phone call that I feel like I, you know, everybody waits, you know, that actor waits for that phone call, like you got the role.
Right.
For me, I had two restaurants in New York City that I was a partner of, and pretty successful restaurants that were going very well.
Sure.
And I had, you know, frustrations with just the idea of shuttling back and forth between these places. The hunger that's attached to the struggle sometimes,
sure,
is something that it's hard to describe unless, you know, there's the creative element inside chefs and I mean, we've spoken about this.
Business,
whether it be
it's cultural in many ways, but there's a desire to succeed
and feel like you're so much capable of more than what you're doing, which was the challenge trying to kind of rein that in to a certain extent and really kind of hone that focus.
Right.
So when I got the phone call to do something in Miami, it took me about 3 years to get that deal signed. it was a long 3 years and a lot of lawsuits.
It wasn't all your fault. That's for sure. But you got that call and then did you immediately think, yeah, I can do this. I can take an outpost. I can do this wonderful thing that I built from, you know, that I birthed, that I raised. And I can take it a couple thousand miles away and make it brilliant.
Well, the challenge with it was I knew that I'd be able to capture the essence of my food. And I think that it's a business decision saying, okay, if I'm not in that kitchen every day, am I comfortable with 95% as opposed to 100% all the time? And that's a business decision. That's something that it's not for everyone. Not everyone wants to. You know, there's some days where it's 110%, but there are those days where it's 95%, and that's the challenge. And can you sleep at night doing that? And can you surround yourself with the right people to be able to execute at the 100% level who are going to be able to complete your sentences?
And is your partner in that endeavor, the hotel in this case, going to commit to your vision as well, right?
Well, you know, absolutely. And I always say, and this is a conversation that we have with hotels all the time, that I'll own it, that I have with the hotels all the time. You can't run a restaurant by the P&L alone, just like you can't run it just from the back of house in the kitchen with the food that you're putting out. There needs to be a combination. There needs to be a dialogue. There needs to be an understanding of both of the equations that are being brought into play. But most importantly, it needs to be understood from the customer perspective as well. Everyone should put themselves in the seat of the customer and say what works and what doesn't work, and let's focus on the art within the confines of the business.
Isn't that a funny little analysis when you step back? Because the hotel used to be the leader of the hospitality industry and the leader in identifying and anticipating guest concerns and guest needs. Yet the growth of the hotel industry requires serious attention paid to every nickel and every dime that is spent. And to bring in a third party, which is a relatively new concept, as we just talked about, and to give them space in your hotel, in your culture, and be able to trust them to operate it in a way that that reflects well both on them and on the restaurateur, which ideally the goal, of course, is to have happy hotel guests and happy customers. But it's funny, the first conversation you have to have is one that says, let me be me.
Yeah, well, right? It's 100%. I go into the hotels, and it's happened more than once. I say, listen, you hired me. You're a client of mine, essentially, for a reason. And the reason is because I have a skill set. I don't go to you and tell you how to run your hotel. Don't tell me how to run a restaurant. You know, there's always going to be issues. It's how you navigate those issues, obviously.
Yeah.
And I've gotten very diplomatic over time and understanding that there's a break and there's a gas, and I know when to use which one for the most part. But, you know, a bigger challenge is the expectations of the customer.
Right.
And how does the hotel understand what their role is? How does the restaurant person understand what their role is? Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, you said that the management deals are a relatively new thing. Do you see what's happening now? I think Hilton in New York City.
Yeah, doing away with room service, right.
Doing away with room service.
I want to have somebody out there. Well, of course it is. Like, I mean, even somebody who's not in the industry can figure out that to have a human being cook something, to have another human being plate it, and to have another human being take it up to somebody's room, A, nothing can go right after it leaves the kitchen, and B, it's a very expensive process. Now, we are in New York. We do talk about unions. There's a little undercurrent that I would talk about in a minute with a hotel person here.
Yes.
But you know, and I know that I read the stories and you read the stories, mm-hmm. and what was not reported? That's a union hotel.
Yeah, no.
And
of
the
course.
Labor expense that goes into room service is frankly, it's not economically feasible.
To say the least.
Yeah. And you know what? Speaking of saying the least, we have sponsors who provide really good money to get their sponsorships played. So I'm going to come back in a couple of minutes with my friend Scott Conant, Chef Super Chef Scott Conant. We're going to talk a little bit more about these third-party contracts. I want to hear about how television has changed the economics of what you do now. And I want to hear a little bit more of the Punch Brothers right now. Who provide us with this great theme music, Movement and Location, from their most recent album, Who's Feeling Young Now? We'll see you in a couple of minutes.
You should visit HearstRanch.com.
Stay in 20.
I never get tired of that mandolin. That's Chris Thiele from the Punch Brothers with Movement and Location. Happy to report that the Punch Brothers are recording a new album. I'm looking forward to its release. And if you ever get a chance to see them, I tell everybody, they'll change your life. Those are five tremendous musicians. Speaking of life changers, I've got one right here. My friend, Scott Conant, who put his clothes back on during the break.
It's a little warm in here.
That's right. It's a little warm in the studio, but that's because there's so much great, great thought and talk going on.
That wasn't
here.
A doorbell either. Just
Scott Conant is one of America's foremost chefs. He is known primarily for Italian cuisine, even though a bit of his training occurred in Germany.
Yes.
I want to figure out how the heck that happened. And now I see him focused on a what appears to be a Caesar salad outside the studio.
That's a nice-looking salad.
Well,
I'm all skin and bones over here.
That's right. Well, I think we're going to work a Roberto's pizza into the event today. But you know what? Before we get back into our conversation that we were going down on the hotel industry and how it's really changed your life, mm-hmm. And the life of restaurateurs, Germany. Yeah, how did that? Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting. Interesting yeah. diversion.
The best laid plans.
Achtung, baby.
I was graduating from CIA from Hyde Park Culinary Institute of America, and Bayerischer Hof Hotel in Munich, Germany, came to the school, and I was so interested in going to Italy, and I figured, you know what? First of all, I need to have a European experience.
Access power.
It's a different conversation. By the way, we could have that conversation. That was a whole different bag of rocks there. But you know, the idea was I figured it'd be easier to work in Italy from getting a job in Italy from Europe than what it would be in the U.S.
That's good blue collar thinking, right there, man. That's very
not good. Smart. Right? Not a smart move. However, because of proximity of Munich, I really I traveled so much. The Germans didn't let me work at all, pretty much, which was fine.
Because you were Metagons?
Pretty much.
Really?
Pretty much. No, yeah. I mean, they had a 40-hour work week, and it was impossible to get a second job. And I needed, because I was an immigrant, I needed to get a job above table, not under the table. So
right.
I would just jump in a car, and I would drive to the Czech Republic. And this was 1992, and the wall had essentially just gone down.
Right.
So I saw amazing things from a historical perspective. It was wonderful.
It must have been interesting because I remember that period of time very well. And Ronald Reagan was the president, and our friends in Europe weren't very happy.
Well,
about 90, that.
92, I think Clinton
was just come in.
Coming in. So he was coming in 93, which is when so it was Bush, Bush the second, but the first, I'm sorry, the elder, Bush elder.
Right.
It's HW, is that what it was? Anyway, so no, but it was one of those very unique periods in history because a lot of Eastern Germans were now coming to the West. It was a unified Germany, and with that were a lot of political tensions as well. And the Germans, I don't know if you know this or not, that they have some pretty fierce political.
Opinions
and views.
Every other generation, they get a little excitable. Yeah,
it was. I mean, some of the things I saw was those are stories for other day, but they were really. It was an interesting. I'm glad that I experienced it. It wasn't the best culinary.
It helped shape.
It shaped me, and I traveled a lot, and it was the goal. I mean, I would steal away 2 hours south through Austria, which I love Austria, and Vienna is one of my favorite cities in the world. I was just saying that earlier today. I would go to Südtirol and to the north of, and it was Italy, but they were still speaking German, and my German wasn't bad, and my Italian wasn't bad, so I was able to communicate, you know, in a couple different languages, and I was fortunate, and the food was great,
right.
You know, still some of those pork dishes, they stick with you, those things.
Well, you know, I don't know if we ever had the conversation, but your colleague over here is half Italian and half German. So
I did not know that.
I did. And I've enjoyed, the German side of my, of my mom's cooking incredibly and still dream about it on a regular basis. Well, we move from Germany. We get to the U.S. We become apprenticed, basically, in an Italian sort of way, though, right? And you got to dig into the style of cooking that you wanted to dig into. And as we spoke about earlier, not every move you made was a success.
No, most weren't.
Well, let's talk about some of the more formidable setbacks. We're sitting here with a guy. Look, let's not kid each other, okay? You're at a point in your life where probably you never thought you'd be.
That's true.
Right. And that's so, true. And you are, even though you are self-deprecating, you are a very successful and influential chef and restaurateur and food, to say a food personality, we've got to come up with a better phrase, you know? But you're an ambassador. You're an ambassador to your industry, right? You influence people. You influence kids as well as others.
Yeah.
I couldn't go to your office today without having someone ask me to bring back a signed photo.
That's
right?
Fair. Yeah,
no,
that's
but you know what that is? That's a microcosm of that means you mean something to someone who doesn't know you.
Yeah.
You know, and they wouldn't have asked for it. I don't think they're going to throw darts at it. But I think the idea is that makes you an ambassador.
They wouldn't be the first.
No, they wouldn't. But makes you an ambassador to your industry.
It's very nice. And by the way, those are never, they never have been the intention. It never will be the intention. I think I always say, and forgive my language, but if you start in this business by that being the goal, then you're just an asshole, and you shouldn't be involved. I know this is a family show.
No, there are other avenues for that. I know.
Be an actor. That's not the goal. If you're after glamour, you're in the wrong industry.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough industry.
You're in the wrong business. Just, get out, do something else.
All right, but I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to get you back to my question because I'm curious. So setbacks. Like, give me one that you thought you'd never recover from.
So I was the chef at a restaurant on West Broadway in New York City. And you know what? I'll even fast forward it.
Okay.
I was on my second. It was 1999. We were coming down the street. It was a restaurant called City Eatery on the Bowery, corner of Bowery and Bleecker. Your favorite name of a restaurant
Eatery.
Is Eatery. I know it's your favorite.
Why not breathing?
So basically, I was the chef in this restaurant, and the owners were very nice, albeit maybe a little bit over their skis. And I came in as the chef, and they were going through some really bad times. They needed to change the restaurant. There was a consultant involved, and he called me and hired me. It was great, and I met some wonderful people who are still good friends today. However, one of the challenges that I dealt with, it was completely underfinanced, and we changed that restaurant from what was Astor Place into the new concept, and we got great reviews. Hal Rubinstein was really kind to us in New York Magazine at the time when he was a critic. And William Grimes was exceptionally
best food writer that I've ever come across. But.
Just amazing. He gave us a great review. He gave us a 2-star review when we probably deserved half a star. They don't give half stars, obviously, the New York Times. So it was great. Essentially, what happened was I didn't get paid and I'm telling you, for months. I didn't get paid for months. And at the time, my roommate, who is a really amazing wine personality, his name is Sergio Esposito. He is an Italian wine merchant on 16th Street. So this was way before he opened up that store. And obviously, we were friends for years in separate rooms. Don't get excited.
Well, I mean, if you weren't paying any rent, if you weren't making any money.
So this is the interesting thing was Sergio would give me his rent check and I would deposit into my account. He thought that I would pay them the rent every month, but I would withdraw the funds and I would have to pay my staff. And I had this amazing set of customers. They would come in once a week, and he was an old school Italian guy from Elizabeth, New Jersey, Dr. Datero, and he would come in, give me a $100 handshake every Thursday. Every Thursday at 6 o'clock, like clockwork, his driver would pull up, he'd get out, silk scarf, sunglasses, $100 handshake, I'd cook for them, my best customers, right? He didn't realize that $100 was all I had to live on
until
the next week that he came in. And after, I think, 3 or 4 months of that, I got an eviction notice, and my roommate called me. He's like, Scott, like, what, you know, what's going on? Like, you know, you're paying the rent. What? Serge, I kind of forgot to tell you.
Oh, my
so
goodness.
He wanted to kill me. I mean, he wanted to kill me. But, you know, for me, after years of therapy, for me, it was really about what's the learning lesson in here? What's the takeaway from that? And I could be bitter and I could be angry. And those people, I think, still owe me $2,500. And I could hold on to that.
That's
or
right.
I could really just put myself in a position to say, listen, what do I learn from it? What can I take away? How do I become a better owner, operator, manager, chef, cook? Based on that,
now, what did you take away? I mean, that's a hell of a distraction to go through life without getting paid.
Well, the takeaway on the other side of it was essentially putting myself in a position to create a hospitality company and never put my employees in that situation that
go.
I was in. So the owner still had the beautiful flat on here, and another guy had another place over there, and they were from a different part of the world,
right?
But the long and short of it was, they capitalized that business on our hard work as a staff. And that is just unacceptable, obviously. I mean, not only is it illegal, but also it's immoral and it lacks integrity. So for me, obviously, the takeaway was, okay, and that's just one of dozens of stories.
Yeah, but that's actually a great hospitality story when you step back and say, you know what, I was in a situation where my trust was abused. It put me in a life-altering circumstance. I was going to lose my living space. And what I'm not ever going to do is I need to make money for my family, but I'm not going to do it, as you pointed out, on the backs of the people who are trusting me and working for
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. And you know, there's so many other things that go along with that, but you know, that trust level that I have in my team, and the trust that hopefully they have in me, I will never take advantage of that the way I was taken advantage of. And it wasn't the only people to do that to me. That happened in at least three other restaurants.
Yeah.
And I've been broke not just that time, but I mean, at least two times beyond that, and probably maybe a little closer to the present than anyone would think, because there's so many things that go along with this business that you don't foresee. You know?
Well, you know, we can spend hours, you know, and probably will at some point with a little more beer. really talking about, you know, these very sharp curves in the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, where you could be heading really down a steep canyon with no brakes, and you know, you'll hit a bump and it'll turn your car, it'll veer it a little bit one way, and all of a sudden an opportunity with some success comes along with it. I really got to ask you the TV thing. I know that television is a double-edged sword. I know that it demands a lot of time. It takes 5 hours for 5 minutes, you know, of what we see out there, right? Has it helped you, both as a restaurateur and a businessman, to have taken that step? Because you've made a commitment now that has you out there, you know, makes you that ambassador to your industry. Has it helped from a business standpoint?
You know, it's helped in the most obvious way, which is just simply people sitting in the seats, mm-hmm. which is the biggest thing.
Yeah,
it's also brought other opportunities to the table, but most importantly, I think the double edge that you're talking about is the. It's very funny because especially in the restaurant world, for some reason, there's this idea that you need to be a certain way in order to be perceived as. Kind of one of the people in the business,
right.
So to speak. So when you start doing a lot of television, you start to spend a lot of time doing any that level of overexposure, what's too much? And do I still have my eye on the goal? My goal is not to be a culinary super god like so many other people are. My goal is to create an advertising platform for the business that I really do, and right. restaurants are really my thing. I grew up, I told you this earlier, right. there's no accounting for, I didn't go to business school. I have an associate's degree in occupational studies from the Culinary Institute of America, which essentially means I'm a cook. Right?
So, it's a great phrase.
You have to learn this on the job, right? I was telling you the other day, I'm a big music fan. I was reading the life story of Jimi Hendrix. I wish I read that book while I was still in school, because it would have put me in a better position and a better understanding of who to surround myself with and who to trust, which is no one, right? Because ultimately, as much as people tell you that they're looking out for your best interest, no one is going to look out for your best interest like you are going to look out for your best interest.
Yeah.
So Jimi Hendrix, by the way, the long story short is that 35 years after his death, his estate was still trying to be figured out, but he had such terrible management around him, which is a shame. He died with $21,000 in the bank, and he committed suicide. It's a shame, right, that one of the greatest recording artists that ever lived. You don't see this stuff in the music world, in the restaurant world. You see it all the time in the music world. There's different things at stake, obviously.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that doesn't come from the same place, that same sense of heart, that same sense of earnestness.
You make a great point. Until recently, you know, it's been the last 10 or 15 years, an individual chef who was going to be a restaurant owner basically had his or her life wrapped up in a lease, right? In one lease. And there was no way to sell your restaurant, you know, when you were tired or when your legs gave out or when, you know, or when your wife left you or whatever. You know, that was it. And so the idea of creating a restaurant group is I think a very normal and natural progression. And then the idea of all of us who come from blue collar origins, who have that little thing on our shoulder that said, if we don't really make this work, you know,
you're going to go back.
Right. And so there you are, right, saying, well, what's going to continue to make it work? Well, if it's being on the business of the business, I'm going to do it. Or if it's being on TV, I'm going to do it. And, you know, fortunately, and I think fortunately, you've embraced it. I think you've been a great ambassador to the hospitality industry. I think you've proven that you can also operate great restaurants, maintain great quality, expand your business, expand your own personal horizons, you know, through exposure in different media outlets. And still every once in a while be able to get your ass out to Bushwick, Brooklyn, have a cold one, indulge in a little bit of pizza, and I'm not gonna belabor you here anymore.
But not to cut you off, but look at those ribs walking in the door right now. You know I'm going to be gnawing on a couple of those in a little while.
Well, you know what? I'm glad we're bringing it back to the basics here, which is we walked into Roberta's today where Scott candidly told me he had never been. I was a little surprised, but I knew from bringing people here that when they walk in and they get a smell of the pizza, the oven, some of the cooking that goes on, they don't want to leave. And I get the feeling that Scott's going to be stuck in traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
He might not get
home.
Don't
tell my wife.
I know nothing. But Scott, I want to thank you so much for coming out today, spending time with me. You've got a fascinating career. I hope we can do it again when your book comes out. Absolutely. I know we got a book. Let's talk about that quickly. You got
October.
A book coming out in October.
Yeah, October, the Scarpetta Cookbook.
Wonderful.
It's just a culmination of all the recipes from all the restaurants, some classics, some new, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, not just tips on food, but also tips on entertaining and what to drink with each dish and recipe. And it really has a great stylistic feel. I'd send you one, but you got to give me a check.
Yeah,
I need
all right.
A new pair of shoes.
Well, you know, I think we just gave you some exposure there, so it puts us about even. All right, everyone. Well, thanks for spending time with us today on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Phil Colicchio. You've listened to The Business of the Business. We try and bring it to you every Wednesday. Can't thank the Heritage Radio Network enough for giving us a platform to talk about the things that interest us. The business of the business is what interests Scott Conant. All right, man, what do you say we get some pizza?
I love it. Thank
More
you.
More ribs.
Thanks for having me on also. It's
Pleasure.
Really a good time.
Pleasure. Dedrick, see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.